You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9am to 12 midday.
Very good morning. I hope you're well. You're welcome to this special edition of Morning Focus here on Clare FM. On this Christmas Eve, as you're putting the finishing touches to your preparations for tomorrow, or maybe as you're out and about buying some last-minute gifts, we're going to ease you into the day with some of our highlights from the year just gone. This morning, remarkable people, remarkable animals, some bits to make you laugh, some tears, some great music, and in short, some of our favourite bits from the year that's now almost totally done. We'll start with one of the more unusual quotes uttered on Clare FM this year by a man who said, accurately, that he'd spent 49 days on my own in a little rowing boat in the middle of the Atlantic. In his own modest way. That's how Gavin Hennigan summed up his quest in the early part of last year when he rowed solo across the Atlantic Ocean. His tale, though, is about more than just this physical achievement, given that it came years after he, by his own admission, had battled addictions with drink and drugs. He overcame this, but now tells his story, frankly, as he did when he joined us in January. At that time, Gavin Hennigan was coming on board with John Burke's Elevate charity, and he told me more.
15 years ago, I ended up in a rehab, actually, in Clare here, Bush Park House, not far from where we are right now, at the age of 21. You know, I had, in a very dark place, emotionally, mentally, physically. You know, I'd had this realisation, you know, through... you know, an intervention with my family that at 21 years old I'd never finished school, never learned how to drive, you know, I'd lost multiple jobs and was, you know, kind of moving from place to place. You know, I'd ended up living in London for the last 2 years from the age of 19 to 21 in a small flat with no furniture in it. And that was because of drink, alcohol and drugs, and, you know, I was heavily addicted. And I mean, I can remember living in this flat and I didn't have any furniture. I had a mattress on the ground and I used to have the windows blacked out with black bags because I didn't even have curtains, you know, and it was just this dark sort of hole. And I remember just waking up in the morning and just like literally getting stoned and going back to sleep, and I was just afraid of reality. And, you know, I could hear like a letter coming through the post box. Yeah. And it was used to scare me, you know. So
I remember one of your interviews that I read that you didn't see the need for furniture, that basically why would I do that when I can put the money into drinking
drugs? I mean, that was like my logic. That was a crazy logic. Why would you spend that money on having furniture when, you know, you could go on drinking drugs? Like, so it was just absolutely insane.
You must have realised that what you were doing was very bad for you. You must have realised that you weren't, you know, living life as it should be lived, I guess.
I mean, deep down, yeah, I did, but I suppose it was, you know, when I look back, like, I think that, you know, the alcohol and drugs kind of was just really a symptom of what was going on underneath, you know. And for me, deep down, I had very, very low self-esteem. You know, I had a lot of anger and stuff as a young man. I was very, very angry. My father was an alcoholic. You know, he was not around when I was a kid, so there was a lot of anger there towards him. You know, personally, myself, I couldn't deal with my own feelings. You know, I was trying to come to the terms with the fact that I was gay. You know, I remember even in that apartment, there was a mirror in the bathroom, and, you know, I'd headbutt it from time to time. You know, you have these like cuts, you know, it's underneath my hair there, scars from it. And like, so it's just, when you look back, you see that real destructive behavior, you know. And I just had no kind of awareness at the time. And, you know, it took going into, you know, rehab and sort of getting kind of clean and sober from alcohol and drugs, and then, you know, doing a lot of work on myself over the years to kind of, you know, get a bit of awareness around myself and realize, you know, that I amn't useless and what all these things that I thought it was, and to really accept myself as for who I am.
Do you fall into that behavior? Is there a point where there is a trigger that leads you down the road where you become an addict and an alcoholic?
Look, that's a hard one. It's a debatable kind of thing. You know, people aren't really sure. Like, is it something that's genetically passed on, or is it something like, I just know for myself, you know, personally, you know, I'm an addict and I'm an alcoholic. One is too many, a thousand never enough. You know, I just know that when it comes to alcohol and drugs, like, I need to abstain, you know, and I just need to be aware of that in everything I do. You know, I can take it to extremes, you know, but that can be done in positive things as well. And you know, that's kind of evident in some of the stuff that I've done over the years since being clean and sober.
So it's that same as you say, in a much more positive way. It's that same maybe addictive personality that pushes you to do to go and roll thousands of kilometres or run several marathons.
All or nothing kind of, you know, and just kind of one track mind, you know, when you get it, when you get it, get something between, you know, between your ears, you know, you want to finish it out and go
for it. You don't have to do it.
Yeah.
What was the turning point that led you from a very dark place to getting onto the road to push you back into where you are now?
I suppose it was my mother, you know. So, you know, she had kind of been through so much with my father over before that, and, you know, she kind of just pushed me towards it when I sort of did kind of break down after coming back from London at 21, and, you know, I came back for a family funeral and kind of things kind of crumbled back at home again. I kind of, everywhere I went, things weren't getting any better, you know. I was kind of trying to, you know, almost do a geographical, if I just move here now, it'll get better, and it never did, because I kept, you know, throwing more alcohol and drugs on top of the problem. So yeah, she, you know, that was a pivotal point for her to, you know, kind of push me that way, and I did kind of go for the rehab. But then I suppose after that, I think it was probably the hardest time, you know, coming out of there after spending those few weeks in there, and then being kind of thrust back into the reality. And the reality was, a 21-year-old living in Galway trying to stay sober is a tough ass. So I had to kind of, you know, kind of divorce myself from all old friends and stuff like that. I had to get a new phone and things. But I was very fortunate. I met this guy who was also at a rehab. His name is John, a friend of mine, close friend today. And he was wanting to go surfing for the first time, and like, I hadn't any money, I was on the dole, and he'd actually been a DJ for a number of years, and he just sold his decks and his DJ equipment, and he had a little bit of money. He said, look, I'm going to buy a wetsuit, will you buy a board? And I said, look, I'll save up the bit of dole money here, and we can go surfing with, you know, the one board and the one wetsuit. So we took off down to Lahinch, you know, sort of in the middle of November. This is, you know, 15 years ago, to give this surfing a go for the first time. And you know, obviously one board and one wetsuit between us. He went out first for a while, and I sat there in the car getting rattled away in the wind and the rain. And he comes in then, and it comes to my turn, and I have to get into a wetsuit that he'd pissed in and head out for a surf. And yeah, look, I didn't get any waves. I nearly got washed up on the rocks a few times. I just kind of flailed around in the white water for an hour, but I suppose something was awoken in me in those moments. And it was just kind of being, you know, thrust around in the power of the Atlantic, and it sort of woke something up in me. And from that point onwards, I was like, right, I need to do more of this. And that surfing became my new addiction. And I went full bore into that, you know, and my life really happened after that. And I suppose it was because I had a purpose. You know, I wasn't thinking to myself, you know, I didn't have the FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out. I wasn't thinking, geez, everyone's down the pub now having the crack. I was thinking to myself, right, let's see what the weather's doing tomorrow morning. Okay, you know, we need to go down to Lahinch again at 6 o'clock in the morning and go for a surf, you know. So I had this purpose and this drive, and that really kept me on the straight and narrow, you know, and it was really important. And that's kind of, you know, kind of the stuff that I've been chasing, you know, down through the years. I've just been sort of looking for something that really sparks something inside me. And, you know, an adventure has been that, you know, it's been in one form or another. You know, I've gone and done so many amazing things. You know, I could go on about it for hours here, you know, over the last 15 years, you know, since being clean and sober, surfing, snowboarding, mountaineering, you know, sailing, rowing, you know, you name it, I've given it a go.
And it all started in a used wetsuit in Lahinch. And why do you think that's, I guess, in inspiring? Because, I mean, it's inspiring for anybody who can physically have their body in such a shape that they can do some of what you have done. Mm. And that's before everything else. But in what way do you hope, through working with Elevate and some of the other bits I know that you've done, I know you're an ambassador with Jigsaw, for example, you'll have spoken with young people before. What about your story do you want them to tap into?
Well, like, I suppose for me, like, I just look back and I think about how I was when I was 19, you know, and in that sort of flat in London and looking at my life at that point, and it was just such a dark place. And, you know, I just really think about, like, what I thought about myself, and I just didn't really think I could amount to anything, you know, and I didn't have any belief, any self-esteem. And today I just look back and I think that was such a crazy thing to think, like, and I just think that's a really, really crazy thing for a young person to think about their lives in any sort of way. And I just want to try and help anyone I can, really, to try and believe that so much is possible. Like, there was so much possible for me at that age at 19, and I just didn't believe it. And I think, you know, it's hard for, you know, this transition from being a young person, you know, from say a primary school into a secondary school, a lot happens, you know, and your self esteem can take quite a knock. You know, for example, I do talks for kids in fifth and sixth class, and you know, I say to them, "Who wants to draw the Atlantic?" And they all stick their hands up. You know, I might ask the same question to secondary school, and they mightn't think, you know what I mean? They, you know, so something happens there, you know, and I think it's important to sort of
they become cynical.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, and start, you know, that sort of. You know, that transition into adulthood, you know, it can be hard, and I think that's where I'm just trying to give people a bit more belief and inspiration, you know, and that's kind of what I've done over the years. I've just sort of, you know, just gone for these kind of crazy ideas and these crazy dreams. Like, I couldn't row 3 years ago. I had no notion how to row. And, you know what I mean? I managed to row across the bloody Atlantic. So, that's just promoting that sort of idea, that message, you know.
It's difficult, though. I mean, you can tell a story in a timeline fashion where you've gone from a dark place to a very positive one, but along the way, and there has to be a lot of bumps, there have to be a lot of tough moments, and I always think it's really important that those are at least alluded to or told, that you share those as well, because you don't want to give, whatever age the kids you're talking to, you don't want to give them the impression that, okay, yes, they can do this, but it's not going to be easy to do it, you know?
No, like, you're dead right. Like, I mean, I suppose, like, rowing the Atlantic, you know, obviously it's something that's inherently very, very dangerous, very risky, you know, to be in a boat completely on your own for 49 days at the mercy of the ocean. And you know, unfortunately, not a lot of people can actually identify with that. You know, there's only been hopefully nearly three Irishmen that have just done it solo. Damien's out there right now. But, you know, less than 150 people have done it in history. So it's not something that people can directly identify with. But what people can identify with, and what young people can identify with, is taking a risk to do something, you know. Like, so the middle of last year, you know, before the row, you know, I had like kind of almost like walked away from my job. I'd spent a lot of my own money on this, you know what I mean? I was in a really scary place, you know, mentally and emotionally, because I was taking this huge risk. And I suppose that's the kind of stuff that people can identify, and young people can identify with. Like, I really want to do this particular course in university, or I want to take off traveling, but I don't know how to do it. And that's kind of where I come in, as in I say, look, you know, you need to try and focus on this goal and not think of like this massive thing at the very end, just to do the next right thing, the next few steps in the process to try and get you towards that. And for me, you know, I have a lot of, despite the things I've done, I have fear, I have doubt, I have anxiety, just like everybody else. I don't care who you are, how successful you are in life, the number of things you have achieved, you have that in you, and everybody has it. It's just, I turn the volume down on it. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't. They have the volume up full blast, and they listen to that fear and doubt and anxiety. They think, I can't do that, I can't do that, sure. What if this happens? What if that happens? And then, of course, you know, they're living a sort of caged life where they're not doing the things that they really want to do.
Gavin Hennigan there on our review of the year on Morning Focus. When we're back, what it's like to hunt the most wanted man in the world. You're welcome back to today's edition of Morning Focus here on Clare FM, in which we are recounting some of our favourite bits from the past 12 months. One of the big TV hits of recent years, although it is broadcast on the streaming service Netflix, is Narcos. The show details the story of two DEA agents in Colombia in the 1990s as they take on huge drugs cartels and the infamous Pablo Escobar. The two men who inspired the show were in Ireland this summer for a tour of a stage show. And ahead of that, I spoke with one of them, Steve Murphy, for an insight into what life was really like. He told me how he'd been fighting drugs in the US before taking the opportunity to travel to South America.
To be honest with you, you know, in Miami in the 1980s was, from a DEA agent's point of view, was very exciting. It was very dangerous. I had a partner shot down there. We had an informant killed during a deal that had gone bad. And you can go back and research the history and just see how violent it was during that time. But from my perspective, it was dangerous, but it was very exciting. You know, and it presented a challenge that you couldn't see anywhere else or participate in anywhere else in the world. And so after several years of doing that in Miami, my wife, believe it or not, actually came to me one day and said, "Hey, what's the next most exciting thing we can do?" So, you know, I said, "Well, we could go to Colombia." And I'd been working a lot of cases with our offices down there, and I got to know some of the agents. And one of the agents came to Miami one day, so my wife and I had dinner with him, and she got to ask him questions and get firsthand information. And a few weeks after that, my wife came to me and said, "You still want to go to Columbia?" And I said, "Of course." And she said, "Let's do it while we're young." So we applied and were accepted, and off we went.
But you would have known, surely, that for all of the opportunities, that there was an inherent danger. I have read that there was a bounty on the heads of DEA agents in Colombia, that if somebody had killed you or one of your colleagues, I saw $300,000 mentioned as a figure.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. It was $300,000, and I was aware of that, and that was just part of the challenge. You know, I like to joke around and say DEA never hired me because I was really smart. But, you know, when you go into that line of work, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's not a job, actually. It's more of a lifestyle. So the one thing I'm really proud of with DEA is most DEA agents have a very strong work ethic. 12, 14, 16, 18-hour days are common. It's not an unusual thing. So to me, it was just a challenge to be met, to experience more excitement, to live in a foreign country, and it was like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, to be honest with you.
And quite a fire indeed. Colombia, particularly at that time, with Pablo Escobar in effect ruling with an iron fist, although not in a literal sense, but it was the drugs and cocaine capital of the world. You were doing important work, obviously.
We were, and that's what helped you stay motivated, because you knew, or at least you felt, you were doing the right thing to try to help your fellow man. And I know that sounds kind of like a holier-than-thou statement, and I don't intend it to say that way. Honestly, since I was a small child, I've never wanted to do anything but be a police officer. And the truth is, when I went to Colombia, I did not know I would be working on the Pablo Escobar investigation.
Okay.
And neither did my partner, Javier. It's one of those things when you get to the office, you know, and you get to know some people, then they decide which operation you're going to work on. And it just so happened that I got along with with Javier and his former partner, Gary Sheridan, very well. And that's how I became part of that team.
And what was it like to know that you were hunting one of the most wanted men in the world, as he was at the time?
I got to be real honest with you. It sets the bar very high. I was a local police officer. I was a uniformed police officer for almost 12 years before I became a federal agent with DEA. And I guess maybe in the back of your mind, you think that, you know, you do get the opportunity to work the biggest drug traffickers in the world. And you have cases. I had cases in Miami that we knew the source of supply was Escobar and the Medellin cartel, but I was never able to build the case up to that high level. So then when you come into Bogota, Colombia, and they say, okay, you're going to be assigned to work with these two guys, and your target is Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel, it's a feeling of exhilaration, but it's also, you're doing some self-introspection, trying to decide, okay, am I up for this task? Can I take on this guy? You know, people would, I mean, you come back to the United States and visit friends, and people say, man, that's the biggest drug trafficker in the world. You know, do you really think you can get him? And quite honestly, Javier and I discussed this. We're thinking, he's so big, we can't miss the guy. We'll get him.
Because you had to?
And that's what happened. Well, you know what? And you do. You have a responsibility, and it's not just to the people in the United States, but, you know, we know Pablo had a negative effect on the entire world when it came to the cocaine market. You know, this guy is nothing more than a mass murderer. He is the world's first narco-terrorist. The world's first narco-terrorist. I mean, that's a significant title to carry. He was the world's most wanted criminal. Javier and I attribute between 10,000 and 15,000 murders to his credit. But one of his sicarios is a free man in Colombia now. He did his prison time. He's a free man down there. He's all over social media and YouTube, and he's written a book, and I think he's done a movie. He says the number is more like 50,000 people that Escobar is responsible for murdering. And that doesn't include all the people that died because using cocaine and all the ills that go along with that. So, you know, here in my country, if somebody kills 3 or 4 people, we call them a mass murderer. What do you call somebody that's killed 50,000 people?
So how do you take on a guy like that? How do you try and get him and capture him, and you are ultimately successful, I know, but I mean, obviously he has a huge army of, you use the term sicario, kind of confidants, people who would do his bidding, who are on his payroll carrying out these crimes on his behalf.
Well, you know, so first of all, Javier and I are nobody special. You know, we're not these big tough guys like it's portrayed in different shows and in books and stuff. we're actually a couple of small-town country boys that have the opportunity to work a really big case. I mean, I like to have fun and say we're not very smart, but, I mean, we're not dumb either. Both of us were local police officers before we became federal agents. When you go to an environment like that, DEA sends you to additional training so that you can, you know, a little bit better prepared to take care of yourself and things like that. But you just go in full force. Mm. So, you know, it's a 7-day a week, 24-hour a day job. You get to go home, especially after you escape from this custom-built prison. You know, it was, you'd get to go home and take a shower. You might get a 4 to 6 hour nap, and then you're back up at it again. Your phone's ringing 24 hours a day. You know, it wasn't unusual for the U.S. ambassador to call you if you happen to be in Bogota and say, I need to see you right away. And so you're in your car heading over to his, you know, the ambassador's residence. My wife was extremely supportive and understanding because I was never home.
Yeah, she so had to be.
I mean, you have to suck it up and do what you have to do.
You were there the day that Pablo Escobar was killed by, well, actually, it's not known who fired the fatal shot, but in an exercise. What are your memories of that day?
Well, and I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me an opportunity to set the record straight. And we do this at every presentation we do, at all of our shows, we tell the truth. I was not there.
Oh, sorry.
That was Narcos portrayed that I was there. I was not. I was back at the police base with the Colombian National Police, and I was actually in Colonel Martinez's office when his son radioed in to say that they had found Pablo Escobar, that they had located him. So the whole operation that took place where Pablo was killed was strictly the Colombian National Police. There were no Americans there. Now, I rode out to the scene with Colonel Martinez, and we were there with probably in 10 to 15 minutes afterwards. It just so happened I had the only camera that worked that day, which is why we have access to all the photographs, because I took them.
Yeah.
But that for us, that's a very important point because, you know, especially here in the United States, people like to call people heroes, you know, and they say, oh, Javier and Steve, those are true American heroes. No, we're not. We're professional law enforcement officers that did our job. The true heroes, in our opinion, are the Colombian National Police because they took their country back that day. But also, all the other heroes are all the innocent people that were murdered simply because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we like to give them the credit.
I knew that you hadn't fired the shot. I knew it was somebody within the Colombian security services. I don't know if it was a police or a special force or whatever. I knew that. But you were, as I say, at the scene a short time later. When you got that call from the colonel's son, when you were told this is end game, and obviously it turned out with Escobar being shot, was the relation? I don't like to say ask that about it, the death of a man, but again, he is somebody, as you've outlined, who perpetrated such evil.
There was elation. If you've seen that famous photograph out there that there's this idiot American agent in a red shirt standing over Pablo's body smiling, if you've seen that idiot is me. And if you look at those photographs, you'll notice that all the police officers are smiling. The reason we're all smiling, and we'll explain this during the show, but the reason we're smiling is because we knew everybody in Colombia was safer at that exact moment. Simply because this guy was no longer amongst the living.
You're over a dead man.
Everybody was happy.
You're smiling while kneeling over a dead man's body. You don't regret that photo?
I did initially, but as you can imagine, I caught a lot of grief over it from Washington. They weren't real happy that photograph was passed around.
Yeah.
And believe me, it wasn't me that passed it around. It was I've got my ideas who passed it around, but. It's not something I ever meant to go public. It was a personal moment for me. But, you know, again, and our show is all about telling the truth, and so I'm being very honest and truthful with you now in this interview. I had no remorse whatsoever. In my opinion, Pablo Escobar got exactly what he deserved that day. What I'm very happy about is that none of the good guys, none of the police officers were injured during that firefight. That's what the man deserved. He deserved no better.
Steve Murphy there, of Narcos fame. When we're back, we'll hear from two of Claire's favourite sons. You're welcome back. In October, Davy Fitzgerald released his new autobiography, At All Costs. It'll be under many of your trees tomorrow, I'm sure. In it, the Six Mile Bridge man reflects on the events of recent years, including Clare's successes under his stewardship, most notably the 2013 All-Ireland Senior Hurling title, and also his departure from that role 3 years later, on a morning in which he received a huge number of appreciative and supportive messages from our Morning Focus listeners. Davy reflected on that time.
It's not about the medals or the cups for me. It's about people. I love seeing people happy. The emotion on people's faces was absolutely incredible. Like, and coming back here and seeing so many people happy, that was absolutely something I'll never forget. And that's, to be honest with you, that's why I do it. It's no other reason, only I love seeing that. And that's happened with various clubs as well, Gavin, down through the years that we've worked with that haven't achieved the whole pile. And I enjoy that. Why I didn't enjoy it, I suppose, is when you're up there, I always have this thing, when you're up there, there's only one place you can go, you know. And
but you weren't going to get knocked down on that Saturday night in September of 2013.
It wasn't, but you know what, I was, to tell you the honest God truth, I was absolutely shattered. I think I went back and stayed in bed for nearly the 1 to 2 days. The mental fatigue of it, it's grand the match, but it's the preparation up to the match, making sure all the guys are right, making sure everything in the backroom setup is right. And thankfully, I had a great lot of assistance as well in that. But you're absolutely fatigued beyond belief, that's to tell you the truth.
Your big decision for that replay was to bring in Shane O'Donnell, and you write about it in the book. One thing I didn't get a sense of, though, was how clear-cut or otherwise a decision it was made. It was definitely the right one. It was a managerial masterstroke. But when did you make up your mind on that one?
A managerial masterstroke, yeah, that's good when they work, right?
exactly.
I can think of a lot of other times that don't work. My mind, be honest, and the lads were the same, we pretty knew after the first day we probably should have let him on there, you know? And even seeing him in training between that and the second day was incredible. But the thing that sticks out in my mind and that I'll never forget was inside in the college beforehand when I actually told him, if you
was
see,
the morning of the
it was the morning of it, yeah. And if you see his face, and I'm actually delighted I didn't do it earlier, that I left it till so late. But my God, just to see his face, and I remember myself, I kind of welled up a smile because I could see how excited he was, and he was raring for road, and that's something that will live with me for a long time. And by God, he didn't let us down.
How did it feel when 1, 2, 3 goals go in all within the first 20 minutes? I mean, I don't know if there was any nagging doubt about the decision, because, you know, you second guess everything as a manager would. You've only got one chance to play your cards, but again, this one went very well.
There's a few things about the All-Ireland. Being honest, I was very, very nervous about the first day, because you're wondering, okay, the lads hadn't played in front of 80,000 people and you're wondering how they're going to be. So it was trying to make sure that they weren't that nervous going to the first day, but my God, I was very, very uptight and trying not to show them because I wanted them to perform so much. Cork would be used to being in situations like that. But would you believe between the first and the second day, no, I was quite relaxed, and we actually did a thing. We trained way less. I'd say we hardly did 3 or 4 sessions in a few weeks. We just brought training way back. We said to ourselves, okay, they have enough done. Trust them. And they were absolutely flying at training, so they were. But no, it's something that'll live with me, the way they played. Like, you know what, the short and the long really suits this team. And I remember going into the dressing room this year when they beat Wexford, and I said, well, you don't mind listening to the few negative people you have back at home, just play what suits you, because they're a unique team. They need to be moving all the time. They're that type of team, and I don't see anything wrong with that. Like, the way we won the All-Ireland, so many people have talked about it, that they were able to move around at speed. Like, some of the goals we got, Conor McGrath's goal stick in my head without a shadow of a doubt. An incredible goal by an incredible talent, you know. So they're the great things. And it's funny, Gavin, coming up that we actually worked on one thing, which was we thought that they might man-mark Tony Kelly, and it was to get Tony out of the centre so that we could allow ourselves to get in the centre, you know.
Space, yeah.
And it actually worked. I mean, they followed Tony, and it allowed Paddy and a few of the lads to run down that centre channel, and that was something that we had talked about. And it's nice. It's great when things come off. It's not so nice when they don't come off, you know.
And how big is the difference then between that victory and defeat between something working and something not, I suppose, because I suppose in many people's eyes, you talk about the detractors, they will look at the years that followed, the delight of 2013 putting one place, but what you would have wished, and you would have wished for more, particularly in the championship.
Yeah, you know, that's funny. We won with probably a bunch of 2021 year olds. Trust me, coping with winning is serious enough. You're elevated to an unbelievable height to cope with that success being brought here, there and every place. That's massive. It's funny, I actually probably had to work harder with the guys and to make sure they were okay and X, Y and Z for a year or two afterwards. I felt myself that they were just starting to come back right in 16. That's my honest opinion. I felt we struggled to cope with that pressure and with that expectation for a while.
Is that... it's not falling off the rails or losing discipline, is it? What changes when the All-Ireland medal's in the pocket?
Listen, there's an awful lot more expectation, one, but you're brought to X, Y and Z, and like, I don't know whether you take your eye off the ball a small bit or where you're... do you really want it as much? I'm not 100% sure, right? But at that, I just believe that maybe at that young age, it's a small bit harder. So it is, if the lads were 3 or 4 more years mature, I think it might have been different. You look at the Kilkenny team that won, probably they were coming 23, 24, 25 when they were really starting to win them and go on and into their late 20s. And that bit of maturity, I feel, maybe was the difference. But... you know what? We've only 4 All-Irelands when I know people would want more and more. Like, Limerick waited a year and years for theirs, and they had won a lot of minors, 21s and everything, which doesn't guarantee success. So I'm grateful for what we've done. And,
of course, yeah.
You know what? I still believe that bunch, they're not far away either, you know, if we just let them do what they're good at doing.
Davy Fitzgerald there. Another GAA man who's been a regular guest on the show this year, particularly at the start of 2018, was Marty Morrissey. The West Clareman joined us on Mondays in January and February as he was lighting up the dance floor on Dancing with the Stars. Now, by his own admission, Marty was never the best dancer, but he might have been the most popular, so it was a real treat to hear him and his partner Ksenia reflect on their time together on the morning after his exit and after a big event for another one of the contestants too.
Marty Morrissey, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you, Kevin? Not too bad.
How was Rob Heffernan's 40th?
Rob's 40th was very good. Tim's with a bit of disappointment, but still a very, you know, we were overall... a great night, I have to say, and it was kind of, to be fair, my fellow colleagues, contestants were a bit saddened at my departure, but that wasn't part of the plan, but
of course.
So be it, that's life.
Well,
me.
How do you feel, much more importantly than that now?
I, to be honest with you, it's a mixed bag. If I was to be honest, and Ksenia's here beside me now as we speak to you, because we're disappointed, but realistic. We're also kind of proud that we got to program 8 out of 12. I mean, you have to be honest in these things. There were better dancers in the competition or in the program than what I could produce. But look, we got to the quarterfinals. As I said to Nikki and Amanda last night, I would give myself a B+ for effort.
Well, you
said to me last November, when I met Ksenia first, last November, if I said, look, we'll make the program 8, then... I would take it with a heart and a half and say thank you, you know. But still disappointed to have left this last night, to be honest with you. And I'll also be honest, we actually thought we might make one more program, Ksenia and myself. But we also knew the competition was hotting up. It is an entertainment show, as I said all along, but ultimately it's built around dancing and a dancing competition. And there were better dancers. But I got to program 8, and I've said it before, Clare FM have been brilliant supporting me, and the people of Clare have been brilliant. And if I may say, my own crowd in Kilmurry O'Brien, in the parish back in West Clare, they were just wonderful. I'm overwhelmed by the generosity and the kindness of people, because I've never gone in for a vote for anything, never. and to get that support from my own people, from the people of Clare, means an awful lot to me, and I will treasure it for the rest of my days. So thank you very, very much.
And thank you as well. Are you glad you went into it? Are you glad, in hindsight, that you took the plunge?
I am. Genuinely, I am. And I've said it many times, I was really hesitant. But, you know, I got to know Ksenia, and we had a great team effort. We really got on very well. She also influenced my posture, my stance, my diet. So I've lost a stone and a bit.
Her mental state.
Her mental state. Hello, people.
Hello.
Hi, Ksenia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
What's it been like to work with Marty over the last...
Absolutely amazing. I think everybody finds it challenging. You know, you're learning a skill, especially for Marty, that he hasn't done before. But he grasped it and he took it on the chin when he had to. And then yet he performed when he needed to. And he knew how to just completely turn it on when he had to.
And there was genuine affection, I thought, at the end there between the pair of you. I get the impression that you've got a friend out of this. You've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, completely.
Has he been a good student?
He has been an excellent student, and I'm grateful for his patience as well with me, because I am quite pushy. I just want the best, and I think he knew this and he realized this, and he just wanted to just take it for what it is and just do his best, really, and make the Clare people proud. And I think he definitely did that.
I know you came down to Clare a few weeks ago as well for the Camaray Brick and Socialist part of this as well. What's it been like being the other half of the Marty party, shall we say?
Oh, I loved it. Unfortunately, when we came down, we didn't have time to enjoy it, really, and I didn't get a chance to see anything because we were just rehearsing all day. Then we had, Marty had the event, and then I was in for rehearsals early in the morning, so we had to literally leave. But from the little bit I had, or the little taste I had, I absolutely loved it, and I love Ireland, so it's a great place with great people.
Will you miss Dancing with the Stars now?
Of course, I love this show. As tiring as it is, and everybody moans, oh, I'm tired, I'm this, I'm that, but deep down, we all love it, and we all love to be part of it.
You've made him a better dancer.
I have. Well, he's made him, you know, it takes two, like they say, it takes two to tango, and as much as it takes somebody to teach, it takes also somebody to want to learn, you know, and he definitely did that, and he definitely did his best, and he did me proud completely.
Great. So is he still there? Is Marty still there?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, just for the last minute there,
because I know your time is tight.
Hi, Gavin.
Marty, you're going to have to dance at every wedding that you go to from now until the end of your dot.
And I'll do the quick step foxtrot. What was the other one we did okay that we got decent marks?
The tango.
Rumba. Oh, yeah. Lady in Red Rumba, I will dance the rumba because it was about the only one I did really well, particularly in the dance-off last night.
Even in the Marty party last night,
we actually ended up, the two of us, doing our rumba routine and getting 10-10-10 from the group. They should have been the judges.
Marty Morrissey there, and Ksenia reflecting on their time together on Dancing with the Stars. We'll go from dancing to drama next. You're welcome back. Now, Clare is a county with plenty of drama, and it's time for one of our favourite performances of recent times. Involved for several years with the very successful Currafin Players, James Ralley brought a one-man show on the road in recent months, performing Flann O'Brien's The Brother. A comedic tale with a number of humorous incidents, here's one of those, as performed by James.
Well, this is the way I'm fixed at the moment. Well, this is the way your man has me written anyhow. Oh, it's no joke, I tell you, when your man does be writing me and the brother. Not now that I mind being back in digs. I mean, the landlady is A-OK, and I have the brother for company. But when your man starts writing, he has no regard for his characters. The brother, of course, he's taken a very dim view of it and thinking of taking it further. A ball of malt, please. The law. Not now that the brother would go near the solicitors. Foot, he says, he would not step inside one of them fellas' doors. Hooks, he says they are. Oh, be God, your man may start to watch out if the brother gets the teeth into him over the law. Yeah, a ball of malt, please. You see, the brother maintains that we are employed by your man as characters, and he only has the right to use us as such, not as every other Tom, Dick and Harry that comes into his head when he's perched up there in the bed writing the books. Oh, be God, your man may start to watch out if the brother gets the teeth into him over the law. That is, of course, if the brother's health holds up. Asher, the brother is a martyr for the bad health. Well, first of all, do you see, there's the Corns. Asher, the Corns has the brother nearly finished with the ball dancing, you know. Yeah, thanks. 1 and 6. Yeah, there you go. Thanks. Not now that he ever complains, of course. I mean, a word of complaint, it never crosses lips. A great man for suffering in silence, the brother. Sure, he's an example to all of us. Well, number one, do you see, the eyes isn't right. Asher, he doesn't know where he does be going or who does be shouting at him after half the time. And then he does have all classes shakes in the hands of a morning time and a very bad case of neuralgia down the left side of the jaw and a fierce backache in the back. And then, of course, the bag does be out of order half the time. Asher, you know what his game is? Eating pills. Asher, he does a feeds of pills above in the digs, the brother. And do you know why? Because he bars the doctors. Oh, he'd die roaring now before you let one of them doctor fellas put a finger on him. And sure, half of the pills he does be taking is poison. Poison, man. Sure, anybody else taking as many pills as the brother would have gone to the wall years ago. But the brother's health stands up to it. Because, you see, he has an iron constitution. Sure, he's a fella there. He could take pills all his life and not be killed by them. Of course, it's my view that it's that that has the bag out of order. And going around like a poison puppy is half the time. He gets the pain here. Look. Oh, a great man for taking care of the bag, the brother. Hot water 3 times a day, and where does it get him? Nowhere. I mean to say now, I wouldn't mind a man who raised a little finger. Whiskey puts a lining like leather on the bag. So a man from Balbriggan was telling me anyways. Be thankful now if the bag is all right, because there's nothing worse nor a bad bag.
James Rally there with an excerpt from Flann O'Brien's The Brother. Still to come this morning, unusual animals, greatness, and one of the most unusual words of the year. You're very welcome back to this, the second hour of our review of the year on Morning Focus here on Clare FM. In effect, some of the best bits from the last 12 months for you to enjoy on this Christmas Eve. Very soon, one of the most powerful speakers to have joined us on air this year. But first, one of the strangest words that was uttered on this show in 2018.
Do you know what clogging is?
No, no.
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 I'm a clue now.
I haven't a clue.
Not a clue.
Not a clue. Not a clue. No.
I haven't a clue. Sorry.
Haven't a clue.
Not a notion.
Not a notion.
Not a notion. First time I heard it.
Do you want to take a guess?
Is it something to do with blogging?
It's something to do probably with the technology anyway.
Technology, so.
I'd imagine so.
A block for electric, something?
Something to do with sex for young people.
It's actually a new word that's going into the dictionary. It's jogging combined with picking up litter.
Jogging and picking up litter? Really? Mm. Oh, it's new.
I think it's brilliant. Brilliant. It's a great idea, yeah.
Oh, very good. Very excellent good. Idea.
Sounds very good.
Oh, I should know what I'm in the tidy towns.
Well, no, it's a fairly new thing.
We start using that word, so.
Do you think so?
I think we will, yeah.
Perfect.
I think there must be better things to be doing now than that, is there?
Well, I think they should just stick to running and picking up litter. I don't think that word is necessary. Confuses people like me, old people.
It's a new word for everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's very positive. Yeah, anything that cleans the streets, so much the best.
Would you join a plogging group yourself?
The reason why people jog on the road instead of the footpath is because these curbs interfere with their jogging. So I can't see them stopping to pick up litter.
I probably would, yeah. Yeah, great crack.
Oh, I would, yeah. I would, definitely.
Oh, yes, possibly, why not?
Who knows?
Who knows? If it catches on enough.
Maybe.
We'll wait and see.
Ryan Hanton there, and many of our Clare FM listeners, on plogging, or, to put it simply, picking up a bit of rubbish while you're out on a jog or a walk. An inspiration maybe for after the Christmas dinner. Now, moving on to something very different, and there's been much discussion about travellers in 2018 in the context of October's presidential election. But way before that, in March in fact, an event was held in Dublin to mark the state's decision in 2017 to formally recognise the ethnicity of Irish travellers. Kathleen Sherlock of Mean Care Whidden was amongst those who organised a major national event, and ahead of it, she joined me in studio. This was a wide-ranging interview. We discussed travellers' rich culture and heritage, as it would also be covered in Kilmainham the following day. I asked Kathleen, a traveller herself, about the recognition of travellers as an ethnic minority and whether she felt it would help highlight the positives within her community.
I think that the recognition of traveller ethnicity is the first step in that. We've a long way to go. Remember that, you know, there has been negative attitudes have built up over the last 50, 60 years and conceptions built up over the last 50 or 60 years.
Are those attitudes as strong now as before?
I think they were pretty bad around the 80s and the 90s. That seemed to be the height of it. But it's still there. We still see it there in access to services. It's absolutely there when you look at the housing situation for the accommodation situation for travellers. We see it absolutely when we look at the percentages around, we'll say, unemployment. The unemployment percentage around travellers is almost 8%, it's somewhere between 80 and 84%. So that's extraordinarily high. Mm. The educational attainment, very poor. The level of bullying, which people don't always appreciate, and they seem to think it's the other way around, but the level of bullying that traveller children, particularly young boys, experience within the school system, it's shocking. The suicide levels that, you know, in my time when I was growing up didn't really exist. Mm. The suicide is skyrocketing, so it's 7 times higher, and it's very high in Ireland, but it's still 7 times higher within the Irish travellers.
Is that because maybe a knock-on impact of some of the issues that you've talked about? If life is tough for people, if they're finding it difficult to get work, you know, it can compound other issues that are there. Does one beget the other, basically?
Well, yeah, suicide is a very complex issue, and I'm not an expert upon suicide.
Sure.
But it absolutely plays a part in it. It can't not.
Yeah.
You have, when you look at, we'll say, the situations, the accommodation situations that many people are living in, you look at children who are now, who've gone to school, maybe their first or second generation living within a town system. So they're looking at the children, the people that they grew up with, going to school with, who they were able to compete with on an equal footage maybe in primary school, and then the gap starts building up afterwards, who are not seeing a prospect of ever having a job or having the same qualities of life, of course.
Yeah. Some people may listen to that, say, for example, on education, and think, well, the opportunities are there for travellers, as they are for all children, there are free, there's free education up to second level, etc. Mm. And maybe feel that individuals could be doing more to try and get themselves ahead.
There's no doubt that traveller families have got to prioritise education, and they have to be pushing their children and supporting their children as much as they absolutely can. That's without a doubt. But we cannot take out of the question and out of the equation that the system does not support a lot of traveller children. In fact, the vast majority of traveller children, it doesn't support them. Nor does it support, in the same way, children who are coming from a disadvantaged backgrounds. And that's just, you know, that's undisputable, because the facts are people who are coming from poor, traveller, disadvantaged backgrounds, they're not achieving and progressing within Irish society at the rates that they should be.
Is that in any way linked in with the attitudes that you talked about a couple of minutes ago? As you will be aware, there are often criticisms of the travelling community at the times of general incidents, and we've seen those locally and nationally, even though they would be the actions of a very small minority.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the reason that people are not attaining or achieving within Irish society and travellers and people coming from working class and poor backgrounds is because of poverty. And I don't, when we think of poverty, you know, in a lot of times we think of the fact that people are starving or hungry or they haven't enough to eat and all the rest of it. Well, that's abject poverty. But so many people in Ireland, and so many people, so many travellers and so many people who are coming from working class and poor backgrounds are dealing with a different type of poverty. It's the poverty that you're barely getting by. It's the poverty that you can't plan ahead, you know, that there's no progression, and that you're always in a survival mode. So that has a real impact. On the other point of it, there is a stereotyping and a perception of who travellers are, and that when you look at, we'll say, a small minority of people who are involved in antisocial behaviour or activities, that seems to be tarred right across the board to all travellers. Now, I do think it's important maybe at this stage as well that we highlight the fact that you know, a lot of there are travellers who are succeeding. There are travellers who are progressing. So there are travellers who now have within third level education. There are people who have achieved their masters and are doing their doctorates.
Sure.
We have travellers who are psychiatrists. We have travellers who are, we have a traveller at the minute who is almost qualified as a brain surgeon. We have travellers who have done very, very, very well in the fields of music and within the arts. We have travellers who have done very well within the sports system. And we have travellers who are working in almost every part of Irish society, whether we have travellers who are guards, we have travellers who are you know, who are working within the trades, and we have travellers who are beauticians and hairdressers. So there is some attainment, but it's not the attainment to the levels that you'd expect.
And those examples that you've highlighted, they are seen as stories of those individuals.
Mm.
Clearly you feel that the negative stories get spread with a much broader brush across the community. Or swathes of the travelling community anyway.
I think that's the perception. The perception would be pretty much always on the negative. And that's something that tomorrow this celebration is going to highlight. And I think that people who come to tomorrow, they will enjoy it. And hopefully it won't be a once-off event. Hopefully that it will be an event that will be run again.
Okay. There's a way to go. To go from the history that you outlined very articulately to a place where we don't have that issue, where we don't have these negative stereotyping. Do you think you can get there?
I think we can. I think we can, and I think we will. We have to kind of focus in our minds that our community is quite a small community. There's less than 40,000 travellers in total. Our community is a very young community. You know, 50. You know, over 50% of travellers are under the age of 25. Now, when we look at the flip side of that, very few travellers will reach 65 years of age. I mean, to get health attainment or life expectancy, it's not the same. So we have a way to go there. But because our community is such a small community, some of the pressure issues that are having a long-term negative effect can be dealt with very quickly, with the right intention, with the right implementation, and that's around accommodation. We would be looking for employers, hopefully, to be opening up their doors, and when they look at diversity, think of travellers as well as part of the diversity programme, and look at maybe opening opportunities there. We need, obviously, support systems that would be put in around, we'll say, to deal with the crisis situation around around suicide and suicide prevention. We also need to be looking at, we'll say, supporting travellers that they are progressing within the school system. But it can be fixed. You know, it's okay. Not that it can't be fixed.
Kathleen Sherlock there. When we're back, a little bit of sweetness. You're welcome back to Morning Focus here on Clare FM on this Christmas Eve and on this Monday morning, of course. One group who've entertained us across the year is our Friday panellists who join us for a chinwag about the week that was, as it was. Sometimes serious, often less so. In October, when I was joined by Martin Waldron, William Cahir and Kay Murphy, I was baffled about a new wave which seemed to be sweeping across part of Dublin. This, the arrival of the Krispy Kreme donut shop in Blanchardstown.
Our Friday panel are still with us in studio, Kay Murphy, Martin Waldron and William Cahir. Martin, some sweetness to finish this morning. Can you please explain to me why there are people in Dublin queuing for hours for donuts? What's going on?
When I saw this, you sent out the topic panel yesterday. And I went, lads, what are you on about? It went completely past me, right? And then I actually started to think about it. And I started to, hang on, what does this mean to you? No, I know nothing about Krispy Kreme, apart from the fact that it's a donut factory. And I'd have my suspicions with people getting a sweet tooth at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, right? there might be some other stimulants in there.
But
I worked in Russia in the early 90s, right? And I remember getting on a train in St. Petersburg, travelling overnight to Moscow, standing outside McDonald's for 3.5 hours in that famous McDonald's opened up in late 1991. Mm-hmm. Stood outside the queue, went up to the counter, and I said, "Can I have 50 Big Macs, please?" So 50 Big Macs. I got 50 Big Macs, packed them away, went back in the train, went back up, and I was involved in a retail business up in St. Petersburg at the time, and we gave them to our staff. And it was a wondrous experience, because it was their first experience of Western fast food. It was an iconic time. And you'd wonder why I did that, right? Yeah. I did it because it was there, and because it was, even though going back 26, 27 years later, it was still... Hey,
you're doing
it
for the experience.
I was there for the experience, right? I'm not so sure that Krispy Kreme at 2 o'clock is the same thing, but it's people queuing up because it's there, because it's new, because
you might actually be onto something. Everybody else is doing it. Maybe.
Yeah, but also because it's something iconic to do. It's the first Krispy Kreme in Ireland. Like, it means nothing to me,
but clearly it does to
other people. You know,
I was thinking, Kay, it's like those the milkshake shops that used to be there. You know, these fads that come along. There's, if you went to Dublin City Centre, there's no shortage of donut shops. Bizarrely enough, I don't know why either, but they're coming to a town near you soon, I would suggest.
I don't know really why you'd want donuts 24/7. Sorry,
me neither.
I mean, the only time I ever ate a donut was at 11 o'clock with my coffee. But in relation to the noise that has been created there as a result of this facility, I spoke earlier on with William. Really, there was a law, and I'm sure it's still enforced, that from light up to lights on to lights off, you didn't honk the horn of your car. You were breaking the law.
Yeah, it's environmental legislation now, though.
Yeah. But I mean, that alone, and even courtesy to where you are, and to take a look at your surroundings, and we've babies, and we've older people, we have people on shift work.
And there are houses very
close. It's shocking.
To be fair, the company have now it's a very short closer, but they're going to close at 11:30 at night and open at 6 in the morning. So they're only going to be selling donuts for 17.5 hours of the day.
But Gavin, everybody knows what Krispy Kreme is now.
It's the best ad. Yeah, that's true.
It probably demonstrates more about the lack of retail bakery offering in Blanchardstown. in fairness, if you think about Ennis, I was thinking about this question, I was going, God, okay, between Carrie's Cakes, O'Connor's, and all of the coffee shops in town that are all making fresh products, I wouldn't see any queue for any in Ennis. You know, we're already spoiled for choice. So
that's true. Yeah. You'll see them coming, though. I guarantee you 12 months' time, we'll go somewhere in town to be a donut shop.
I know. Well, we have an excellent donut shop down in the market, Talking Donuts.
And
it's spectacular. Yeah. Across from Zest.
There's an ad.
No, and equally so, but Zest are doing donuts. O'Connor's. And I mean, if you go to any of the bakeries in Ennis on a Saturday morning, there's huge queues for the products.
And so I know that, but I suppose it's just kind of the donut chic, kind of, if you know what I mean.
Try out all the ones in town. They're all making donuts, and in fairness, they're all delicious.
I think the Krispy Kreme model is not one donut. It's 6 or 12 or 24 in a massive box.
All right. Everything is big in America. You're right there, Martin.
That's why a lot of things are big in America.
Part of one Friday panel discussion in October. And speaking of things that are big, they don't get much bigger than our next item. We'll tell you more in 2 minutes' time. You're welcome back to today's special edition of Morning Focus, in which we're looking back on the year that was on this show. We're going back to February now, and the return to Bunratty Castle and Folk Park of an animal, which has played an important role in its history.
These two are the best temperament you would ever find. They're great with everybody, they're great with kids. They're so quiet. They're two big softies, you know, for the size of them.
That's Seamus Murrahy. He's the farm manager at Bunratty Castle and Folk Park, and he's the man tasked with the care of the newest arrivals, a lovely pair of female wolfhounds. The noble breed has been a feature of life at the 15th century Tower House since significant restoration in the early 1960s, and they have a long association with the nobility, as Niall O'Callaghan, managing director of Shannon Heritage, explains.
The Irish Wolfhound history is fascinating, really. They've been known to be in existence here long before Christianity even came to Ireland, so going back 300-500 BC. And actually, ironically enough, Julius Caesar even wrote about Irish Wolfhounds. He was gifted them at one stage in his reign. So the history behind them is fantastic. And obviously, you know, Bunratty Castle being the most complete fortified castle in Ireland and the most original castle here, no better home to have a fabulous, noble animal like Irish wolfhounds back in their natural habitat here.
The decision to bring the Irish wolfhound back to Bunratty, as Niall says, sees the site going back to its roots.
Yeah, I suppose we've always had wolfhounds here at Bunratty Castle and Folk Park, going back to when we first started the medieval banquets here in 1962 and up until recent years. And we sat down as a management team a couple of months back, and we kind of agreed on one basic principle, that we would try and go back to our roots and go back to what made us famous originally, which was putting the visitor experience first. So we went out and asked our visitors what they would like to see at Bunratty Castle and Folk Park. And the overwhelming response was that they'd love to see Irish wolfhounds back in their natural habitat. So coming from that, then we decided to bring them back.
What kind of an undertaking was that, Niall? Was there an amount of research involved in sourcing these two gorgeous animals in the first place?
We actually thought it would be a lot harder than it was, to be fair. And we have a fantastic team here who manage the farm and have a great network of contacts. And we managed to locate a well-renowned breeder in Munster to provide them. And actually, he came up to Bunratty Castle and Folk Park before he agreed to sell them to us, to make sure that the habitat and the living conditions would be up to scratch, because they are a fantastic animal, obviously, and a very noble dog. So that gave us confidence that they were bred in the right atmosphere as well. So overall, it was, you know, the breeder was happy, we were happy, and obviously delighted to see the reaction with visitors here today and over the last number of weeks since we brought them into the park.
It must add hugely to the visitor experience.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said earlier, that's something that we are very conscious of here, is enhancing the visitor experience at Bunratty Castle and Folk Park and across all our attractions, be that Craigenown, be that Dungura or Napole Castle, or further afield in King John's Castle in Limerick or in our Dublin site. So something we're very passionate about, and this is just one small step on the way to improving and enhancing that experience. So we've got big plans for many of our sites, particularly here in our home at Bunratty Castle, which we will hopefully see to come to fruition in the next 18 months. But this is just the start of a journey that we are undertaking to significantly improve the visitor experience and also help develop Clare as a tourism destination. Obviously, the likes of Cliffs of Moher has been extremely successful, and there's some fantastic other assets, the likes of Loop Head or the Burn Geopark, and there's lots of other stakeholders in Clare who we are keen to work with to ensure that people actually come to Clare and stay in Clare. There's so much to see here.
And in terms of these two new additions at Bunratty Castle and Folk Park, what has the reaction been of visitors? I know it is still early in the year, but even today you can see that people really warm to them.
Absolutely. It's been incredible, to be quite honest, and far bigger reaction than what we anticipated, if truth be told. You know, the first day they actually came into the park at all, we had just a quiet number of visitors here on the park, and literally as soon as people were aware that they were here, everybody descended on that one location to see them. So the reaction has been incredible. We've had thousands and thousands of interactions on Facebook and social media around them, and we've had a lot of coverage in the last week alone. So as the season picks up over the next couple of weeks, we anticipate a large number of visitors coming back to the castle and the folk park to see the wolfhounds, but also maybe reimagine and re-experience what Bunratty Castle and Folk Park is for some people who may not have been here in a long time.
Ivan Toohey is the general manager of Bunratty Castle and Folk Park. He agrees that the interest in the Irish Wolfhounds has been huge, and the team are keen to make them as accessible as possible to visitors.
The main thing, I suppose, the Wolfhounds will be on display every day. So we have a lovely field identified that's fenced off, and whether you're at the playground or the HP Parlour or on the village street, you can see the dogs. That's the first thing. The second part then is that we're actually putting on display, I suppose, now, daily walks. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have walks 3 to 4 times a day, and they'll be on public display once the dogs settle in with us and bed down. So for we have our farmer, I suppose, Seamus, and he's going to be, I suppose, walking the dogs around the ground. We'll have set a route. So that will give, I suppose, the customer and the children the interaction and the opportunity to say, walk at 2 o'clock, go around and learn about the dog, interact with the dog. But I suppose there's a management there in terms of our side, so we'll manage the aspect of the connectivity, I suppose, and I suppose, and the messaging as well.
It's early in the season, but you can see that people are mad for them.
Very early in the season, and the one thing that we're finding is people are actually coming to the front desk and saying, where are the dogs? Yeah. Ourselves, we're getting text messages saying, are the dogs there today? Are they on display? And of course, they're here every day with us. But the reaction has been very positive. And I suppose we've been kind of flabbergasted, really, I suppose, with how positive it has been. And it beggars belief, really, like, you know. And I suppose, really, what it has done for us is that it's given us more energy and more motivation to say, we're going to do more. Because sometimes you kind of look at these projects and these assignments and say, look, will they actually add any value to the customer? And that's what, I suppose, the core part that we look at is, does it add value to the customer? And I suppose, and I know it's early in January, and I suppose it's given us great motivation now to do more and more for the season ahead.
And then finally, Ivan, I know Niall has alluded to plans maybe to acquire further animals. Have you anything in mind just yet?
We do. Another colleague of mine, Aegon, is working on a full list of new animals. So we have, I suppose, traditionally, we have lots of the sheep and the goats. And the goats are a big hit too, because we have about 8 goats and little billy goats coming and going. But no, we actually going to start implementing new animals maybe every second month, because we have 26 acres here. So we have lots of room and lots of capacity to add more animals. And again, I suppose it goes back to my earlier point in that, but the staff are going to be very involved in terms of what animals we bring on board. So if we as a team, staff and managers feel, that animal may not work here, we don't know much about it, it's a case of, look, we won't do that. But I suppose the fact that we've had a very positive experience working from the wolfhounds, I think a lot of it will be going back to our roots and see, look, what kind of old animals there was in this area and this region, and start implementing them in a proper manner.
Bringing Irish wolfhounds back has brought great excitement to visitors and the Bunratty staff alike. Farm manager Seamus Murray says he's been building on his knowledge of the breed.
I knew about the size of them, and I knew they were going to take a lot of care. I didn't realise how strong they were going to be when you were bringing them around, but I'm getting well used to them now. But I've done an awful lot of research into them since. They're a very interesting breed, and there's a lot of history behind them, you know.
We haven't heard them bark, and we've been here quite a while, and I think there's been a tiny peep out of one of them, but they're obviously fairly quiet.
They are. Well, they're happy. they hardly hear a peep out of them. Nothing all day. Nothing at all. Though.
Tell me a little bit about their daily routine then, Seamus. Is this going to form most of your job, looking after the two?
It takes up a good bit of the day, all right. Because they're so big, they need a lot of care, and you need to be very observant with them because they can have a lot of problems because of the size of them. Walking them now is it's good. It's a good brisk walk every
day. What kind of, how many miles, how many kilometres?
I'm not sure. I go around the folk park maybe 4 or 5 times every day, so it's a good stretch. It's a good big stretch, like, you know, because they need a lot of exercise because of the size of them. But maybe I'm getting fit myself out of it as well. You know?
What about their diet and what they eat?
At the moment, now I'm giving them a formulation for bigger dogs over a certain weight, so they're getting that. But every now and again, I'll throw them in a bit of mince or a bit of fish or something just to treat them, and a couple of biscuits.
Would they eat a lot in the day?
You'd be surprised. They don't eat much now. They don't eat an awful lot. They'll eat more than their average dog, obviously, but for the size of them, they don't eat as much as you think they'd eat. There's loads of people trying to give them treats along the way, so they're fine. There's no fear of them anyway.
And are they fond of the treats?
Love them. Love them. Yeah. Can't get enough of them.
In terms, James, of their grooming, then they have beautiful coats. Yeah. They're gorgeous. Is there a lot of grooming involved?
Twice a week I'll try and comb them out, and I'll try and give them a wash then once a week. They got special treatment now for, they were on television last weekend, so they're exceptional now today. But I'll try and keep them that way if I can anyway. I don't have any glitter spray from now today for the radio, so it's all right.
In terms of that, the washing process, I mean, there are some dogs who just absolutely hate it. How did the girls girls react?
The older one who's fine, she stands there, no problem. The younger one is a bit more lively now, but she'll come around eventually, I hope, or else I'll go home wet every day.
And as Seamus says, these noble and friendly dogs are settling in well to their new home and making a big impression all around.
They're lovely. They're friendly all the time. They want to be playing all the time. They also want to go do a bit of hunting every now and again with the chickens around here, but I have to keep a tight hold of them. There's a lot of nervous poultry around here since they came, but they're okay. They're getting on fine. Hopefully they'll be friends eventually, because they are very friendly. They're friendly with everyone. So if all the animals can get on together in the folk park, that'll be the best thing.
Clare FM's Fiona McGarry there with that report. Now, the Irish Wolfhounds weren't the only animals to pique our interest this year. Remember the geep in Mayo this April? The sheep and the goat that got together? Well, the owner of the ram, Michael Holmes from Mulranny, will jog your memory.
Welcome back. You'll recall just over a year ago how we had a bit of an agricultural miracle of our own here in County Clare. Miracle in a very loose term, of course. But this is the birth of the quad cows, identical female quad cows born on the farm of Tom Clare and Ennis Diamond. Now Mayo are getting in on the act with another farming community there celebrating their own rare birth. A male sheep has mated with a female goat and there are now twin geeps. To tell us more, I'm joined in the line now by Michael Holmes. His family are from Mulranny in County Mayo and they are the owner of the ram involved, I think it is. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
And thanks very much for joining us. I've tried to explain it. I hope I've done an all right job. Tell us how exactly this happened, first of all.
Well, we own a farm about 30 miles away near Claremorris there in Murnin in Claremorris. And when we bought the farm there about 2 years ago, the lady that owned the goat, Angela Birmingham, bought the farmhouse and the farmyard and the lawns and all of that around it. So she always kept this goat, you know, and the goat, as goats do, were jumping in and out to our land, and there was no issue there. And everything was grand until we had, my son had a flock of ewes there in November time, and he had Cheviot ram with them, and the goat decided to jump out, but unlike other times she didn't jump in for about a week again, so she waited there with the ram and the sheep. And you know, Angela at the time did suspect that there might be something going on, but I didn't take it too serious. But this is the end result.
And was this a surprise result when the twins emerged?
Well, it was really, you know, it was a surprise, surely. I haven't heard of this happening before, and I wouldn't be very knowledgeable on it, you know. As I once said, I would know a little bit about sheep, all right. I was the national chair of the IFA Sheep Committee for a number of years, so I know a fair bit about sheep, but I would know very little about goats, and certainly I know zero about leaps.
Well, at the same time, you're the only man I've got to ask about them, so you're going to have to tell us.
Yeah, right.
It's obviously a geep is, you know, half goat, half sheep. What do they look like?
Well, I think you answered the question there. They look by half goat, half sheep. You know, and anybody that saw the pics from yesterday would maybe realise that, you know, you could pass them off for being two lambs, but you could also pass them off for being two kids. You know, but there's a lot of things that you can see there in them that you'd know they're not normal, either goats or sheep, you know.
So just you'd know it's not one or the other, basically.
Yeah, you would indeed.
Okay, are they in good health?
Oh, they're in very good health, you know, which I'm told is most unusual. It's unusual for geeps to survive, and for twin geeps to survive, I'm told, is unheard of, you know. But not alone have they survived, but they're in great health. Like, they're jumping up and down and playing, and you know, they're very playful, and I can tell you that they're certainly being well looked after by Angela, because if I or you was as well looked after, we would be very happy.
She's given them some interesting names as well, I see.
She has this and that, and of course that comes from a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know. So yeah, she had given them a very, very interesting name. Some of the guys here in Mayo are starting to say now that there was two geeps born in Mayo before, two singles, one in 1950 and one in 51. Now, anybody that, you know, knows the importance of 50 and 51 to Mayo, because those were the two last years we won the All-Ireland.
If that is
So
the pressure that could be on you and these animals if you're trying to put Sam Maguire in the back of these games.
Well, you see, what they're saying now is, you see, the fact that there were two singles in 1 in 50 and 1 in 51, but now the fact that there are twins, some are saying that we will probably win the senior and minor this year, you know. There would be some people a little bit more optimistic, and they're saying we probably would win the football and the hurling. So you can tell your colleagues down there in Clare, you know, to be on alert.
Those sporting dreams didn't work out for poor Mayo in 2018. That's Michael Holmes. Maybe next year will be theirs in football anyways. We've one more part in our Morning Focus recap, and it'll come from one of my favourite shows of 2018. Don't miss it. You're welcome back. Today we're looking back at some of our best bits, and there was loads to choose from. But only one item this year could be described as our greatest. For months up to May, we asked you to select and vote for Clare's greatest ever person. And you did. In your thousands. For dozens and dozens of brilliant people who prove there is certainly greatness abound in the banner. But one man shone above them all, and it was the late Dr. Brendan O'Regan who was bestowed with this most unique title. He was an innovator, a visionary and a peacemaker whose legacy can be seen all over this county and beyond. Nowhere is his influence more apparent than, of course, at Shannon Airport. And rarely has it been more obvious than in a memorable evening when we gathered there with some of those who knew Brendan O'Regan to remember him. We spoke with people from the airport, but it was some of his former staff who summed up his influence and his impact best of all. You're very welcome back. We're still here this evening at Shannon Airport as we celebrate the life of Clare's greatest ever person, Dr. Brendan O'Regan, the man who you have chosen after a search of a number of months, the businessman, the visionary, the peacekeeper, the man who did so much to build the airport around us, the airport that is so important to this county and indeed this region. Important too in the lives of the people who have worked here. And we're going to meet some of the former Shannon staff who've joined us this evening now. First of all, Marjorie Higgins. Marjorie, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me. And I just want to say I came from Dublin in 65 to stay to try it for about 3 months, and I never went back. And I think Brendan O'Regan gave me and others the best life a person could have, working and retiring, and it's still going on.
That's a fabulous testament to say. Where were you working yourself?
I started in the men's department and I ended up buying the perfumes. So that's all due to Brendan O'Regan. He gave me such a purpose and such an adventurous life that it's just unbelievable.
What I really like about this is when you're talking to me, you've got a big smile on your face, and your tribute is very warm. Your story is typical too of so many other people who came here to work and set up life here and set up families here and so much more.
Yes, and if it wasn't for him, I honestly don't know where I would be, but I know I wouldn't be as happy as I am.
Marjorie, that's lovely. Thank you very much. Marjorie Higgins there. John Ryan is here as well. John, thank you very much for joining us this evening. How long were you working here in Shannon?
Well, now, funny enough, Brendan's father gave me a note to come back to see Larry Blake, wasn't it? Jerry Blake, personnel manager. And I was here, I came on the 1st of May, 1955. Some will say that's why it became a bank holiday later. And I didn't leave, I think I set a record for good, better and different for 48 years and 8 months service. And
it's okay. You're a bit emotional. We'll give you a moment, but he's done so much, and I'm so glad that you're here, that the legacy of Shannon has meant so much to you and to so many others.
Absolutely. Rearing a family in Cretlow, and thanks to Brendan. There's so many things. You see, Brendan started duty free, mail order, hotel college, Bunratty Castle, Shannon Development, Industrial Estate, Shannon Town, and the Peace Initiative. And what he started in Blackrock College, his secondary school. And can you imagine a man telling McQuaid to introduce hurling to Blackrock College? Now, there had been hurling It had died. And he went to Dr. McQuaid and he said, and there was hurling. Brendan won junior hurling with Blackrock College and senior hurling and played for Leinster Colleges. And he went from that to an old man doing Uber above a new market. A lifetime. Some of us are like a star. We'll shine for a short period in our personal life or private lives or work lives or hurling lives even. We'll shine for a moment, won't we? Like a star, and we'll burn out. Brendan shone from the day he went to Blackrock College till virtually the day he died. Outstanding, outstanding man. There are so many things. He got Bernard McDonagh to buy them all in Castle. Bernard then built three hotels in the area. He got Mr. McCarthy, didn't he, to build Shannon, the Shannon Shamrock. He got Lord Gort involved in Murnaty Castle to start that. Then he got some lady involved. Lady, he was to tell us who this lady was up in Drumgoura Castle. He was an outstanding, absolutely outstanding man.
And he's meant an awful lot to you as well.
As now, when Clare FM started their campaign with the 20 most famous Clare people.
Yes, the greatest people.
And every one of them deserving in their own right. And I said from day one, I said there are three anyway. Brian Boru, Michael Cusick and Brendan O'Regan. But we had to come down in favour of Brendan for longevity. Michael Cusick didn't last very long. But Brian Boru got a short finish too. So Brendan lasted a lifetime, virtually. Outstanding. And may I finish by complimenting the authors of the biography.
Yes.
Brendan merited a serious biography. It wasn't easy to do it. They spent years at it with background staff and it does, I think it does the man justice. I doubt that there'll be a better biography of Brendan.
It's by Brian O'Connell and Keane O'Carroll. John, thank you very much as well to give it the due credit because I think a lot of people will be very interested in the story in the back of this. John, thank you very much. And Kitty is here as well. Kitty, tell me, how long were you working here?
34 years.
And
I started in 1959 and I finished in 1995.
And what does this place mean to you?
I had a great life from it. Still enjoying.
You're emotional as well, and a lot of people have been this evening. Do you mind me asking you why?
Because I had such good memories, wonderful memories, and still a big, happy family. Wonderful. We had concessions, everything. We had food, we had holidays, we had everything. It was wonderful. He was a wonderful man.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Some former staff of Shannon Airport remembering the late Dr. Brendan O'Regan there, Clare's greatest ever person, as chosen by you, the listeners, to Clare FM's Morning Focus. The award was accepted on behalf of the O'Regan family by his son, Declan.
My father would have been honoured and humbled to receive awards such as this. He was always a proud Clareman, and his birthplace of Six Mile Bridge was particularly proud of. The legacies of a large amount of his work are here in Clare. Duty Free, Shannon Town, the Industrial Estate, Shannon Heritage, and the Hotel School. My father always said that it was the charm, hard work and support of the people of Clare which enabled his endeavours to succeed. I would like to thank again the people of Clare for this very special award.
Declan O'Regan there, the son of Clare's greatest ever person, Dr. Brendan O'Regan. And that, as an honour that you bestowed upon him, is a fitting way to end this morning, as it also allows me to say thank you to you, the Clare FM audience, for your unwavering support and for listening across the year. I literally couldn't do it without you, and I look forward to doing it all over again in 2019. I want to thank all of our guests, particularly our regular contributors. I'd love to thank my Clare FM colleagues for all of their help, one of them in particular, and that is Fiona McGarry. To you at home, a happy and a safe Christmas.
You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9 a.m. to 12 midday.